This is The End User, episode 134 for Tuesday, May 7th, a ringing endorsement. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr, and I'm very excited this week, Chris, because it seems like all of our stories are coming just straight out of the future.
Well, they're by definition most of the time coming straight out of the future.
No, they're by definition most of the time coming straight out of the past, since, you know, we review other news articles. But this week we have a Senate that passed a bill that can't be from the present. That's either got to be from the far past or far future. And then Acer has all these new things out, and some of them are just positively insane looking, like they came out of some sort of sci-fi movie, like from 100 years in the future. And then we've got stuff that hasn't even come out yet, crazy new TVs. I'm really excited. But the big one is that, I mean, it's not super exciting news, but the bill that the Senate passed was the official Internet sales tax, so otherwise known as the Marketplace Fairness Act.
Right, and this had to happen eventually, right? We couldn't just keep getting free lunch on the internet forever.
Right, we couldn't. And there was a lot of debate about how they wanted to do it, but they did it.
So this is particularly going to hit Amazon is the first one that comes to my mind, because they've been doing some kind of legal battle in the past few years to try and not have this happen, because it's one of their big advantages, right?
Right. Now, if you order something online from a company that has a retail presence in your state, then you just pay whatever sales tax that you would normally pay in that state. But if there is no presence there, like, for example, Amazon, who only sells stuff online, then you wouldn't have to pay sales tax. And so this bill makes it so that those companies that got around the sales tax now have an alternative sales tax.
So it was always my understanding that you were actually supposed to self-report the things that you bought on Amazon, and then the appropriate tax would be applied to you. But I don't think anyone actually really did that, right? That was always kind of a, you know, something that was on the books, but nobody was actually doing.
Yeah, I never saw that in any tax documents or read about it. So I guess nobody was doing it.
Yeah, it was so ubiquitous, I think, that you maybe you didn't even know about it.
Well, anyway, there's not a whole lot much more to say about this story for lawmakers and people who like to follow politics. There may be a lot to say, but, you know, from a tech perspective, the only thing is the stuff that you buy online is going to cost a little bit more money.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move into Acer's lineup. They've released a trio of products that are going to come to market soon. They haven't quite made it yet. And the most interesting of which is the Acer Aspire R7. It's some kind of weird hybrid laptop that they inverted the keyboard and the trackpad so that the trackpad is at the top and the keyboard is at the front. Then instead of it opening like a clamshell, the hinge kind of pops out and kind of floats in midair. And it's got some kind of notion of like a VESA mount or something like that that hangs off the back of the bottom part of the machine, and then the screen tilts backwards so that it's kind of floating in midair. Very bizarre looking.
Right, and then it's a touch screen too. So the idea is you just position this however the screen is most comfortable for you to use it as a touch screen or not, whatever you're using it for. But it does give this, you know, this thing that's technically a laptop, it makes it look like some sort of computer that no one's ever seen before. It's very strange and new. I don't think I would like having my trackpad past my keyboard, but then, you know, maybe with Windows 8, I wouldn't even use the trackpad that much.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the idea, is that this is an experiment to see if well, I guess you don't need your trackpad, so you can just kind of hide it behind the screen, and you can have a screen that's upright and closer to your hands as you're typing. So I don't know. I could see this kind of working out well, although it seems a little too wacky to me to really catch on. Like, I think we figured out what laptops are supposed to be, whether they're touch or not, and this is not that, but I don't know. I definitely could be wrong about that.
Well, we figured out what laptops are supposed to be for right now, but that is, I mean, you're talking about a paradigm that doesn't include touchscreens. So maybe we do need to rethink what a laptop will be, and maybe Acer's got the right idea here.
Yeah, perhaps. It's very interesting, if nothing else. I would love to get my hands on this and actually do something with it. So the screen is pretty nice. It's 15.6 inches. It's 1080p, which is nice. It's a pretty nice screen for any laptop, really. And it's one of these low-voltage Core i5s that is very similar to the one I have in my notebook, actually. So it'll perform adequately.
Yeah, it should, especially if it ships after Intel is shipping their next-generation low-voltage Core i5s. I don't know if it will or not, but it might.
Yeah, and the keyboard's backlit. That's always a nice touch.
They make computers without backlit keyboards?
Yeah, because it's a lot cheaper.
I don't know, Chris. I haven't seen a computer without a backlit keyboard in a long time.
No, a lot of... in fact, I'd say most computers do not have a backlit keyboard.
It sounds wrong to me.
I understand why it sounds wrong to you, but I think that is reality.
Well, it's time to change reality.
I agree. I'd love to see every computer ever have a backlit keyboard.
So, but you said that Acer had three new things out this week, right?
That's right. So the other two are a little bit less exciting just because they're not as wacky. They're not as weird. The second one we're going to talk about is like this same computer's baby brother. And it's got a... it's a smaller screen. It's got 11.6 inches, and they said it was, it's not HD, so I'd assume it's either 720p or slightly below that, is my guess, and this is a Core i3, so this is basically one step down, and they're going to have this out for around $800, they said, so it's a little bit different, and it's got a similar mechanism to the screen rotating around, but it doesn't have the... like stiff hinge so that the screen stays in place. It more like folds over like the Microsoft Surface does.
Yeah, I was going to say it looks a lot like the Microsoft Surface smart cover.
Yeah, so again, a little less interesting, but I'd have to imagine the other one is going to cost over $1,000 easily.
I think if anything, this one is more interesting. For one, the bezel is really small. This thing is like almost all just screen and keyboard. It looks really cool to me. The stylus is a little weird, but some people want that, and I guess the people who don't can just get rid of it. But the other thing is that this looks like the kind of thing that people want when they want a really small computer. You know, when netbooks came out, and like the original 12-inch PowerBook G4. These were really small computers at the time, and for a while computers were just getting bigger and bigger or cheaper and cheaper. So something that has the ability to do real work in a very small package is something that we've seen less and less of in the laptop industry in the last few years. And this could really capitalize on that market because it's... so small, but still as capable as a modern laptop. I mean, so like you said, it's an 11.6 inch screen, and it only weighs 2 pounds.
Yeah, it's only 2 pounds, and that's about how much those old netbooks weighed as well. So, is this the modern netbook, perhaps? Except for the price tag, I guess.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to call it a netbook when it's almost more of a tablet. But I think it is going to be very attractive to certain people who want a lot of power in a small package, which netbooks weren't.
All right, and the last product that Acer is talking about here is the they originally said it was going to be $169, and they said dollars, and that they said they updated the article later saying that it's going to be $199 in the U.S. And this is a 7.9-inch tablet that's 1024 by 768, and this is definitely a bargain tablet. It's coming in under the price of the iPad Mini. So it's running Android, although they didn't say what kind of Android. And it kind of rounds out the lineup there. So this is their competitor to the iPad Mini and the Nexus 7, right?
And it's basically the exact same screen as the iPad Mini. So it's 1024 by 768, but it's a 7.9-inch IPS right. LCD display. That's exactly the screen that they put in the iPad Mini. And it costs like one-third less than the iPad Mini, so or even more than that. So it's the same screen, and it's a lot cheaper.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a budget tablet, and it's kind of what we expect from it. And for a budget tablet, that looks pretty nice, I think.
It could be. I mean, people have complained a lot about the screen in the iPad Mini. It's probably going to get replaced this year with a much nicer screen. But to be able to compete on that front is admirable, at least, although I don't think that this would be a good purchase for most people, even at $200.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think the people that are going to go out and buy this kind of device, they're not expecting an iPad Mini. They're expecting
My only point is that the feature that they tried to emulate is not that great a feature.
Yeah, I could see that. All right, so let's move into the last of our top news here before we turn on the afterburners. So start preparing yourself now. But Adobe is taking a huge shift in strategy. They've been selling desktop software for many years. I can't even quantify how many years they've been selling professional, creative desktop software.
But in their current incarnation, Photoshop, I mean, you know, I don't know what else is in the Creative Suite, but the Creative Suite, now in version 6, has been around for 10 years, but they're ditching it completely.
Yeah, so they're trying to move toward a cloud strategy of some sort, and I think what is interesting here is not that they're actually moving to the cloud. Like, they're not actually moving to web apps and some kind of syncing utility. You know, they're not actually going to the cloud in that regard. They're just trying to move to a subscription model, and they're wrapping the word cloud around it and moving all of their software to the subscription model that happens to auto update. So I don't know. This is very strange to me. I wonder if this will trigger a lot of creative folks to move off of it. But, you know, all those creative folks are addicted to it. So I don't know. That might be a tough sell, though.
You're right. The word cloud is just bad branding for them. I mean, what most people think of cloud, what I think of cloud software is that they're holding your files for you. They're doing the heavy lifting for you. For Adobe, that would be a huge problem. I mean, Photoshop work with a bunch of filters on it, you know, a single picture can get up well over a gigabyte.
Yeah, and so they've got a bunch of different tiers, and I don't really want to go into the harrowing details of what includes all the plans, but we'll just say it starts at $20 a month for students, and it ends at $70 a month for the more professional suite of things. So I don't know. I've got my Photoshop CS6 here, and you know, I'm probably going to hold on to that one for a long time. So I can't imagine paying a monthly fee for this kind of software. It's definitely a reversal, and you know, a lot of companies are starting to do this. So maybe I just need to get used to it. I hate to think that that's the case, but this is a huge shift for them, and I'm not excited to see it.
Well, they made the shift a little bit faster than Microsoft did, but Microsoft is trying to do this for Office. They're still selling, single-use, single-license versions, but they're trying to make you pay for it on an annual basis.
Yeah, I mean, well, the thing with Office is that they gave you both options, and I do wonder if that's temporary. you know, if they're not going to slowly bring you around and then kill off the standalone version, because they basically priced it out of the market and they say, well, but okay, if you really want to do that, here it is. And Adobe is not doing that. I have to wonder if they're going to back off a little bit on this and then eventually do this, but just back off the time scale.
Well, either it will work or they will back off.
Yeah, well, that's true. So maybe they're throwing this out there to see how people react. And they'll adjust accordingly, you know.
That is probably not the best plan.
Yeah, and one other note is that they are killing off Fireworks completely. So that product is going to be gone. I know Richard from the DMZ will be very sad about that.
Yeah, that is too bad. So a very strange move from Adobe. I don't have their creative suite. I will not be getting their creative cloud. But I look forward to seeing what sort of backlash they face.
Yeah, I mean, if this is totally incensing to you, you can always go with GIMP. But that's kind of the same breath as telling somebody who's used Windows for 10 years to go ahead and use Ubuntu. There's a learning curve there, right?
Yeah, it's more complicated than you made it sound.
So if you want to, you can go use GIMP. But again, you might have some trouble with that. All right, so should we turn on our afterburners? Is that what we should do now? Do you have your seatbelt on?
Let me get it on. All right, I got my seatbelt on. I'm ready for the afterburners.
So Amazon mistakenly released some details about Acer's 8-inch Windows 8 tablet, which is very interesting. This is not a size of device that we have seen before with Windows 8. So they put up a listing for this Acer tablet, and it was 1280 by 800, 8.1-inch screen for $379.99. So that must be what's coming down the pipe at some point. Whoops.
Another futuristic future device from Acer. Very exciting. Right. Now, we don't know for sure that all of these are going to be in the final product because it was just a leak. But it looks like it's probably something that's very close to final release. And I think the market could probably use an 8-inch Windows RT tablet.
Why not? I'll try it.
All right, so LG is launching a 55-inch OLED TV. This one is curved. The idea is that it gives you more of a IMAX theater-like experience. It's a gorgeous TV. I don't know how the curve plays in real life. I've never seen one. But it will be available worldwide by the end of the year if you are the kind of person who's willing to spend $12,000 to $15,000 for a TV.
Sign me up. I will definitely not spend that much on this TV, but man, it looks fantastic.
It does.
So maybe we can get some Google Hangouts on that TV, and they're also adding remote desktop. So they had added this previously for their support personnel so that they could help you troubleshoot whatever it was you needed help with. And they've gone ahead and added it to Google Hangouts for everyone. So if you are somebody who would like to provide some tech help for people, then this will come in some handy, I suppose. And I have to imagine podcasters like us will get a lot of use out of this, too.
Yeah, I think so. I only generally use screen sharing features for helping family members with technical difficulties. But there's no reason not to try Hangouts more now that there's more features available. AT&T is starting a new program where you can trade in your old smartphone to get a credit on the new smartphone. They're saying that you can receive at least $100 off of a new smartphone for trading in your old one, and possibly up to $499. This is not always going to be a great value, but it is convenient if you have an old AT&T smartphone and are upgrading to a new AT&T smartphone. So if you really want the best value for your money, you should shop around. You'll probably get a better deal elsewhere, but if you just want to conveniently dispose of your old phone, you might get some decent money for it.
Cool, that's good to hear. So, Taylor, you can unbuckle your seatbelt as we are turning off the afterburners. Are you ready to get into the end user stories?
Yeah, sure.
Take a gulp of water, whatever you need to do to prepare for this. So
I will just have a little bit of honey here.
Yeah, very appropriate, because what the next
from this honeypot, which is actually a bunch of fake passwords designed to trap hackers.
So are you going to set up a hacker trap with a honeypot of easy passwords?
Well, no, but that's what this story's about, right?
Yeah, and I thought this was so clever. So what they're talking about here is sites that are prone to leaking their database. As we've seen time and time and time again, we saw it with Living Social last week. We saw it with LinkedIn earlier, and Twitter, and so on. It happens a lot. And so what we do is we hash the passwords so that the people who get the database cannot see what the actual password is to protect the users who use the same password on separate sites. That's what we do now. And this is another approach. It augments that. I mean, you still have to do that. But so you put a bunch of low-hanging fruit out there that has really easy passwords. And you wait for that account to be compromised. And when it's compromised, you know that your database has leaked, and you get an alert as such. So I just thought this was incredibly clever.
Yeah, it is really clever. And I really like this story for pretty much the same reason. Just like you said, we've been seeing so many of these password attacks, and we just have the same security. You can hash, you can salt the passwords, and you can encrypt them. And we have various levels of encryption that have been getting a little bit better. But all it does is delay the time that a hacker will be able to crack those passwords. It just makes them throw more computing power at it for a larger amount of time until they crack the password. So this is actually the first step that I've seen in a while where we can fight back against password theft.
Right. So, well, in some cases, the encryption, the hashing is strong enough that it would take like the rest of the time of the universe to crack the password. So computing power isn't quite there, but the thing is that computing power is getting more powerful over time. And so these kind of things get a little bit easier. So it's not to say that if you're using modern standards that you're in any danger if your database leaks as the website proprietor, but you can protect your users that way. But this is active in a way that is not. I mean, part of the problem is that your database gets out there, and then what? You know, you find out 6 months later. So that's exactly what you don't want to have happen. So this will further protect the end user and the consumer of whatever website leaks its database. Now, it shouldn't happen in the first place, but we can see from past experience now that this is unavoidable. So I'm really excited to see some thinking about this. And this is so obvious. It's one of those things that in retrospect is so obvious. Of course we should be doing this. And I hope people actually adopt something like this, if not this itself. So I'm excited. This is cool.
Yeah. Totally. It's very cool. It probably won't have any immediate effect on the end users, but it'll make them more safe in the long run. So it's good.
Yeah, you have to do nothing and you will be more safe.
Right. But there is another thing that Facebook is setting up to allow you to make your account more secure, or at least make it easier to get back into it if it is hacked. So they're implementing this new thing called Trusted Contacts, which basically you identify, a friend who is either unlikely to get hacked or betray you, or both, I guess, ideally.
That's very dramatic.
And Facebook will then send password reset codes to them instead of you if your account is hacked.
Yeah, I understand the motivation behind this, and I think I'm the wrong person to do this because I think for most people it makes sense. It's pragmatic in a way. But I don't generally trust other people with that kind of information. So I'm not sure. I'm definitely not going to turn this on. But for your average user, it actually does make some kind of sense.
Yeah, I think so.
But, you know, if you've got... if you've got your password protected in LastPass and you're using two-factor auth and stuff like that, I mean, you've got better ways of doing this.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I don't think that this feature is aimed at those people. But it is nice that if you don't want to use it, you don't have to. It's opt-in, not opt-out, even though it's Facebook.
Yeah. Well, it's good to see they're at least they're thinking about this problem. And this is a way that I have not seen before.
Right. They're thinking about it, and they're not forcing it upon you.
Yeah. So I like the fact that they're rolling it out, although I tell you I'm not going to be turning it on.
I probably won't either, but we both recommend it.
a ringing endorsement there.
All right, so our next story is a bit of news that comes out of Intel. I already mentioned their next generation processor platform, which is codenamed Haswell, and they've released some more details about it, which I thought were really interesting. Mainly, they are launching a multi-year, multi-platform graphics brand called Iris. So Iris is going to be what they're going to call their performance graphics chipsets from now on. Just like AMD has Radeon graphics, and
so this is the replacement.
NVIDIA has GeForce graphics.
This is the replacement for Ivy Bridge HD 4000 and what was it? I think it was HD 3000 before.
Well, see, they will still have that other platform. So their baseline low voltage chips will be running HD 5000 graphics. But then for their mid-level chips, they're going to be running HD 5100, but then that's going to be called Intel Iris.
Okay, so it's kind of a new tier above that. So if you want to
exactly,
have,
it's above the HD graphics.
If battery life is important to you, you're going to get the HD graphics, and it's going to perform a little bit worse. And the other way around is true for Iris.
Pretty much, yeah, because the graphics chip is actually incredibly power efficient. But it's only going to be available in the higher power processors.
Right. Now, I mean, the one thing that they have done recently is that, along with speed increases and the like, which we expect, maybe we're unreasonable to expect that, but they have really done a lot to help these chips not guzzle the battery down so quickly. They're still not quite there. I mean, it's still, you know, ARM is particularly good at that, and that's the chip that's in tablets and the like. So, but they've done a lot of work in that, and it's starting to pay off now. And I think this is the next version of that. Even the Iris upscale version is going to be vastly more efficient, right?
Yeah, it absolutely will be. But this time around, they're focusing on just coming out with really great graphics. You know, they want to have their integrated system graphics really compete with Radeon and GeForce. I mean, right now, if you have a really good computer, it's got Intel HD graphics in it, but you probably have a separate video card. They want to have a full system solution, and that's why they're launching this new brand.
Cool. So I can't wait to see where that goes. It'll be interesting. But I guess we'll start seeing some more system on a chip as well, the Haswell that we were talking about. I think that's going to be really popular.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, AMD is already doing it. Everybody, yep. Phone and tablet is doing a system on a chip. So Intel's been working on system on chip for a long time. So this is a logical evolution for them, and I'm really excited. I'm pretty sure that my next computer is going to be Intel with Iris.
Yeah, I do wonder, you know, coming from our perspective, the people who like to build their own computers, like myself, you know, they're going to be kind of up a creek, because with the efficiencies that come with a system on a chip, you can't really put your own computer together. I mean, you can get the motherboard, you can put it in a case and all that kind of stuff, but you're not going to be able to choose your processor, the RAM's going to be soldered in, that kind of thing. So it's going to be kind of a different era here.
Yeah, it probably will, but they're going to be better computers? Does that make you feel better?
It does make me feel better.
Okay, good. I was worried.
All right, so let's move into our last The End User story, and we've got one that's slightly controversial. So what do you got?
All right, this is my green tech story for the week, and it is unfortunately not much of a green tech story, but I read this and I couldn't ignore it. I had to talk about it. So a study that came out in the latest edition of PNAS, I don't even know what that is, but it's a scholarly journal, and the study was wondering how listing the environmental advantages, you know, the environmental good stuff about a product on the package affects how many people buy it or how much they're willing to pay for it. And they ended up finding this strange thing where among a certain group of people, the more features that are environmentally friendly listed on the product actually cause people to be less likely to buy it or would pay less for it. In economics, those are really closely related characteristics.
So if you look at this from a business perspective, that gets really interesting because
right, because
the lost sales from this one particular group mean that you should not put that kind of branding on it, or does the opposite group that would be more likely to buy it make up the sales? That's very interesting.
All right. Well, if I was a business and I was making, say, an LED light bulb, and I wanted to sell as many of them as possible, after this story, I would maybe make two different packages for my light bulb. One of them says, you are helping the earth by buying this light bulb and not having to throw it out for 20 years and by using 5 times less power than you did before. And the other one would just say, you'll save a bunch of money because you won't have to replace this light bulb for 20 years and it's going to cost you less in electricity.
Yeah, maybe.
But the weirdest thing about this study is that they figured out who it is or what factor is likely to make a person not want to buy something when it's advertised as environmentally friendly. And that factor turns out to be how politically conservative that person is.
And this is specifically in the U.S., right?
Yes, this is specifically in the U.S.
Interesting. So, again, you said it exactly right. It's a likelihood game.
Right. It's all just probabilities and statistics. But it was a definite, clear correlation. The more conservatively minded you are in terms of U.S. politics, the less likely you will buy a product that has environmental notices on its packaging.
Yeah, environmental branding and
right.
And messaging and green packaging and stuff like that.
And it just seems ridiculous to me. Like, who would be deterred by that?
Also,
it was something that you were probably looking at buying anyway. How is it not better?
Yeah, that is a little strange. And in fact, it's so strange, I wonder how the researchers even did. They just make this observation by accident or something? They're like, oh, look at that. That's interesting.
No, I mean, in the final form of the study, they essentially knew that they were looking for this specific type of thing. And they identified it with surveys, and they added up all the results, and they found a clear correlation.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but businesses will have to take that into account at very least. Yeah, very, very, very strange.
Yes, very strange indeed. But if you were the kind of person who is more likely to buy something if it's environmentally branded, then I say, good for you. Don't change. You're not the weird one.
All right. Well, let's get into our tip of the week. And you've got is this 2 weeks in a row that you've got Windows tips for us? Because last week we had some kind of Windows 8 tip, didn't we?
Don't we have a tip for our listeners, Chris? This tip is not for me or for you. It's for our listeners. It's for the show.
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose so.
So, yeah, maybe I found it, but you know what, Chris? That's just because you're slacking.
Yeah, that's true. I'm always, I'm like tip of the week challenged. I have a hard time finding a good tip of the week. And you always find a better one. Even if I did find another one, you always trump me.
Well, that's probably just because I read Lifehacker. I mean, all of our tips come from Lifehacker. We love Lifehacker. Good job, Lifehacker. Anyway, this one is a Windows tip, and it's actually something that I come across a lot talking to people, clients, basically anybody who uses Windows Vista 7 or 8, and it's the user account control prompt. So I could give a crack at explaining what that is, but Chris, you'd probably do a better job.
Right, so it's basically when you get the big black screen with the yes or no buttons and you can allow a program admin access or deny it admin access. And I've always found this to be a little strange because it's like, well, do you want to open up your computer to have everything happen to it or just deny it entirely? So it's a bit binary to me. So that's always been a little strange to me. You know, the Android, for example, you can deny access to the GPS chip if you would like to do that. And I think that's a more appropriate model. But Windows and OS X both are kind of stuck in the past in that regard. And both of them are implementing more granular permissions as well with their stores. So very interesting to move.
But the main idea is that when you run a program, Windows asks you, you know, are you sure you want to do this? This is going to access everything in your system. You know, is this the program that you intended to run? So Windows 7 in particular, in my experience, can be a little overzealous with these user account control prompts. And some people are just completely overwhelmed by these. Now, if you're one of these people, you can do this one thing that will help whittle down some of these prompts and make them appear less frequently. And to do that, you can just go into your task schedule library and make a whitelist of user account control programs. And so then they will automatically bypass that system access prompt. Now, they won't make them go away completely, and you don't want them to go away completely because that is a level of security for your system. Without it, you're more vulnerable to being exploited. But if you're overwhelmed by them and you know of a few of the few that you would like to get rid of specifically, you can do that with this how-to from Lifehacker.
Yeah, that's not a bad way of doing it while we wait to go into the new era of granular permissions.
Ah, yes. It will be a lovely day when that happens.
It will.
And I have an app pick this week, since I'm taking credit for all of my stories now.
Though,
and this one is for Chrome. Now, if you are a Chrome Power user, you know that Chrome has a type of app called a packaged app. And what it does is it just takes a website, you know, a tab from Chrome, and lets it operate independently as its own program, its own window. And some of them are a little bit more customized. They have a nice little interface. It's still basically just a Chrome browser, but some of them look a lot nicer, and maybe you knew about it and maybe you didn't. The good news is that the Chrome Web Store has a dedicated section for packaged apps. So you can go check out the Web Store. You can find this section. And now you can see all of these apps that run as if they were standalone programs.
Yeah, so this is like a apps pick of the week with an S on the end, because you could make any app you want out of this thing.
Right. So some people really like using these packaged apps, and more people don't seem to know about them. So if it sounds intriguing to you, you should check it out.
Yeah, I definitely did not know about them, so I'm going to head over there after the show and see what's going on there.
Wow, really? You didn't know about them? I'm surprised.
No, I knew about the Chrome pinning apps and stuff like
that.
Oh,
but you didn't know about the section?
Yeah, no, not this packaging stuff. Because I feel like I kind of ignore the Chrome Web Store, because there were too many apps that were just links to websites. And so this is a little bit different, though. This is interesting.
Right. Even though it's just an app to a tab to a website.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's okay. If I'm sure it'll apply to some subset of people. So that's pretty neat.
I'm sure it will. All right, last story this week. It's an XKCD webcomic.
You can't go wrong with an XKCD webcomic, right?
You can go pretty wrong with an XKCD webcomic, but you can also go pretty right. Sometimes he just likes to do the math for you, just calculate something out. And this week, what he did was he answered a question. If you have a task, how much time can you spend making it more efficient before you're spending more time working on making it efficient than you save by doing it? And he came up with a little chart. How often do you do the task, and how much time do you shave by making it more efficient? And then he tells you how long you can spend on making it better.
Cool. So this isn't actually like a study or anything, right? But this seems like a pretty good rule of thumb.
Well, it doesn't need to be a study because it's just math.
Well, but it would be different for different people depending on how effective they were at doing automation tasks. What if all of your tasks were only automation?
That probably applies to a certain subset of people.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But Randall Munroe, the author, he actually did go and point out that just the act of looking at the chart should be factored into how much time you're spending on making your task more efficient.
Yeah, that's interesting. And especially with – you've got so many automation options nowadays. I mean, you don't have to be a developer like you used to have to be to get a lot of the benefit of automation like this. So,
well, this doesn't even apply necessarily to computers. You're talking about taking any task,
right,
and spending time to make it faster.
Right. But it particularly applies with computers in my world, I think. But
really? Do you use computers a lot, Chris?
Yeah, I think I do.
I don't. But, only for this show.
But, I mean, just the explosion of the if this, then that teaches you something about how to automate some things. There's a lot of good stuff out there.
True. Automator for Mac.
Don't take it too far.
Helpful. Yeah, this tells you how far you can take it.
Cool. All right. Well, that's all we got for this show. So I wanted to mention something before we got out of here. So Richard and Josh from the DMZ, who host on Entertainment 2.0, have been working on something recently, and we're going to get some a little bit more information in the next coming weeks. And they're thinking about starting a podcast about home automation, which I know both of them are incredibly passionate about. So stay tuned for a little more information in the next coming weeks, and we'll let you know. We'll tweet about it, and we'll probably mention it at the end of the show next week as well. So stay tuned for them, and you can follow at DigiMediaZone on Twitter if you want to stay close to that one. So Taylor, speaking of staying tuned, if people wanted to stay tuned to you, how would they do that?
Well, they could just follow me around, you know. maybe keep your distance, just, you know, to be polite. Invest in a good pair of binoculars. I mean, I guess you could get one of those laser snoopers that read sound vibrations off of window panes. But that's a little bit creepy. I would prefer if you didn't do that.
Is there perhaps some kind of way on the internet that they could contact you in some way?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Google Plus.
How about Google Plus? You're not there enough.
I'm not there enough. You know, that's absolutely right. I guess you just search for my name, right? I think that's how you do it. But you can't just search for my name on Twitter. So on Twitter, I'm at TaylorPhone.
All right. And if you wanted to get at me, Twitter is also a good way for me. It's at Chris Hill Barnes. So give us a follow, and you can follow us both. We are
at The End User.
Thank you. So I think that will do it for this week. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, at thedigitalmediazone.com under The End User. That's T-H-E-N-D-U-S-R. DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. And some home automation podcasts coming up soon. Stay tuned for that, like I mentioned.
Awesome.
You can send us some feedback if you'd like. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, like we mentioned, at theenduser. Join us live in the chat room as we record the show every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.